teachings are ever present, yet often missed. May we hear them, receive them, absorb and maintain them.
It's nice to see so many of you here today. We don't usually put out emails saying, please come to the Dharma talk. So I imagine people think whatever they think. One person said they thought I was going to announce we were closing the center today. That's a catastrophic thinking. And then I also heard that today I was going to announce the real key to getting enlightened. And believe it or not, this came from the same person who thought we were going to close the center. Ever since I've been teaching, it's been, I believe, since 1995, I've been very regularly returning to the subject of practicing with fear. Why? Partly because fear is what drives so much of our human behavior, and also because it's the one emotion that for most of us is the thing that we least want to feel. I remember when I first started my spiritual journey, I had the expectation that practice would allow me to become free of my anxiety and fear. My thought was that if I practiced really hard, if I meditated, if I struggled with my behaviors, that I would actually be able to replace these undesirable parts of myself, the anxiety, the fear, with a new, improved version that was calm and basically imperturbable. So from the very beginning of my particular practice, I decided to confront my fears whenever they arose. And the idea was, by confronting them directly, I would be able to struggle with them and actually amputate them. So I would do things, for example, like when I'd go to work, I'd wear clothes that didn't look good so I could confront and amputate my fear of being disapproved of. Or I remember I had a very strong fear of speaking publicly in those days, and I would force myself into situations where I would have to speak publicly. Again, by confronting it, I could wipe it out. I know some of you have heard this story, but not all of you. In my early days of practice, one of my teachers told me that he thought it would be a very good task for me to go to the pier at Fisherman's Wharf. I lived in San Francisco at the time. And sing a song to all the people who are waiting for the cable car to turn around. So I made up a song. It was like a Bob Dylan-like song. And I bought a black derby hat that I was going to bake for money when I sang. And I went to Fisherman's Wharf, and there were literally hundreds of people there waiting for the cable car to turn around. And I actually still remember this. I was so scared, I was so petrified, that I thought I was going to faint or throw up. But I also had a really strong, you could call it desire, need to free myself from my fears, because they were so much constricting my life. So I went ahead with it. I sang my song, I put out my black derby hat, I even made money. I mean, it was a very, very bizarre experience. But the thing is, it got, as I sang it, I did it a few times. It got easier and easier. And I actually believed that I had overcome my fear. my fear of performing in front of large groups of people. What I didn't realize was that it was, in a way, just like cutting off a weed. You're not really addressing the root. You're not really addressing what's really going on. And so naturally, over time, the basic or more deep-seated fear returned. The reason I wanted to talk about this example, it's because it illustrates two of the classic misconceptions that I think almost all of us have when we begin practice in relation to fear. And the first one is seeing fear as the enemy, seeing it as the flaw or the weakness within ourselves that we have to somehow conquer and obliterate. Maybe all of you don't have this, but I suspect the majority of you have had this at some point. The second misconception is believing that if I confront my fears, if I go against them in a like a direct way, that I'll be able to get rid of them permanently, that they really will disappear just by struggling with them. In a way, it's very understandable that we'd have misconceptions like these because we have such a strong visceral aversion to the discomfort of fear that we'll do almost anything to get rid of them, to get them out of our life. Yet, it's also a fact that when we don't really address our fear, maybe in a more conscious way, that we make it more solid. We make our lives smaller, more limited, more contracted. You could even say that whenever we give in to fear, we cease to live genuinely. We cease to truly live. We're all a little bit different by type, by upbringing, and each of us will deal with fear in our own way. But one thing that's true for all of us is when our own particular conditioning gets triggered, it's going to cause a fear response in the body. So for example, if we get criticized or judged, the body might react as if there's actual danger. This could also occur again, individually, if we fear confrontation, or if we fear intimacy, or if we fear failure, or on and on. When these situations arise, the body senses danger, and it will go either into the fight, or flight, or freeze mode. And so what happens in the body is the adrenaline starts to flow, the heart starts to beat faster, the whole body mechanism begins to close down and contract. Again, we don't want to feel this. So what we do from very early on in our lives is we develop strategies to help us control our world so we don't have to feel these fears. So for some people, they may develop the strategy of trying harder. Other people, it might be trying to please people. Maybe someone develops the strategy of hiding. And this becomes our basic way of relating to the world. My own strategy, in the most part, was to try harder. And it's interesting, because even though this did allow me to achieve external success in that the fear drove me to excel, it never really worked for what I wanted it to do, because it never addressed the core fear. The core fear and all of the day-to-day anxiety that rose out of that could only be put at bay temporarily. But there is another way to live our lives, one that is no longer driven by fear. And in fact, the essence of living authentically, living a truly genuine life, is when we can begin to relate to fear, our own fear, in a new way. So to start, instead of seeing fear as the enemy, as the flaw, as the weakness, we can reframe our whole mental way of looking at it and begin to see it truly as our wake up, as our signal. What I'm talking about is each time we have an occurrence of fear arise, we see it as an opportunity to work with exactly where we are stuck in the moment. We could see it as the exact place where we're holding ourselves back, or as the place where possibly we can truly open to our life. What we have to understand is fear is actually the protective cocoon of the ego, and it's telling us to stop. Fear is telling us, don't go beyond the outer protective layer of this cocoon. But the direction of our path is to move directly toward our fears. It goes against what the fear mechanism is telling us, because only in this way can we move beyond fear's cocoon. It's interesting because even though we may not like fear, fear is the best indicator that we're going in the right direction. In fact, whatever it is that we can't say yes to is the exact direction of our path. And this is something that's critical to remember. And we have to remember it with the mind, because the body will always be telling us the opposite. The body will be telling us, no, turn away. And yet the conscious mind, the mind that wants to wake up, is saying, this is the exact direction that I need to go in if I want to be free. What does it actually mean to say yes to fear? We talk about it a lot. And unfortunately, when we use words a lot, they tend to lose their real meaning. So saying yes to fear simply means we're willing to open to it and embrace it as our path to freedom. It doesn't mean necessarily that we like it, because the chances are we're not going to like it. But it means we're willing to feel what it really is, which is something that we rarely do. In fact, saying yes is the exact opposite of what we usually do, which is to run away from it, to turn away from it, to not want to feel it. It's possible when we stop resisting what is, including our fear, and develop a genuine curiosity toward wanting to know what's really going on, we can begin to look at fear more as an adventure, a learning experience. This is the mind of curiosity, rather than as a nightmare, which is how we normally look at it. When fear arises, the mind of curiosity can say, and this is paraphrasing Stephen Levine, here it is again. What is it going to feel like this time? And really wanting to know. Really wanting to know what fear is. If we really want to know what fear is, whenever it arises, we just have to ask the question, what is this? We're not asking why we have it. We're not analyzing what it's about. We're just asking, what is this? Which is the same as saying, what is this moment? What is the present moment? Because the present moment is fear. And to answer, and we all know this because it's our basic practice, we just need to look at two things. We need to look at the fear-based thoughts that may be racing through the mind, and we need to turn to the physical experience of how fear manifests in the body. So the practice when fear arises is to pause, to just stop, because we need to put a punctuation mark where what we're normally going to do is turn away from fear, try to get away from it. We pause and we observe the thoughts going through the mind, and then we feel physically what's going on. I want to give you an example of the process. This is from several years ago. I had to have a test to determine if I had prostate cancer, and I didn't have any physical symptoms. But I remember the days of waiting for the results of the exam were, they were really just filled with anxiety and fear for me, because this was, for me, the one thing that I didn't want to deal with, having to deal with prostate cancer. This is just my own conditioning, okay? Somebody else in the room might think, no big deal. Probably not, but but this was something for me that triggered a lot of anxiety. So waiting for the test results brought up all of my deepest fear-based conditioning. When I tried to observe the mind, it was very hard in this case to catch the specific thoughts. It was more just a general feeling of doom and dread. It wasn't so much there were specific things that I were believing, but staying with it, watching the mind, asking what's the most believed thought, over the couple days that this was going on, gradually, you know, the little snippets of thoughts became very clear. I can't handle this. What if I have cancer? What's going to happen to me? Just the usual suspects. The thoughts at the time, I remember, seemed very solid, very compelling. But as we do in this practice, staying with them, observing them, labeling them, they do lose their solidity and their power to generate a state in the body dissipates over time. And then I brought awareness to the physical experience in the body, and again, by asking the question, what is this? I remember this being the most difficult I ever had, working with the question, what is this? Because the physical sensations were so strong that there was a real aversion to even wanting to entertain them for more than a few seconds. The feeling was, maybe some of you could relate to this, it was just like the whole body was closing down into this very narrow and dark subjective experience. It was almost claustrophobic. And along with it, of course, was the agitation in the heart, the feelings of nausea, the tightness all over the body, a narrowing down of perceptions where I could hardly even see what was right in front of me. So I asked the question over again, what is this? And I was never able to stay with it consistently for a long period of time. It was more like a back and forth between being able to stay with it for a few seconds, several seconds, and then swerving away into some form of comfort and relief. And it was particularly difficult to stay with the feeling of dread, because at the time it almost felt like death. I mean, I wasn't dying. I didn't even know if I had anything, but it felt like that in the body. But again, this took a few days. Over time, asking what is this, and particularly saying yes to the experience, gradually being willing to feel it more and more with the mind of curiosity, the very solid experience of dread and doom, darkness, gradually changed and transformed. The point of this is, even if we may feel very strong fear, where it may feel like terror, the fact is, in most cases, there's no real physical danger. Like in this case, there was nothing actually happening other than what was happening in my mind. And so there's no need to panic, and it's possible to see this. There's actually no need to even have to push away the experience. And as we let it in, what's actually happening is we're giving up our fear of fear, giving up our fear of fear itself. I know in the midst of this, we may think that we can't stand it. But the fact is, we simply don't want to. It's not that we can't. So saying yes to fear is the countermeasure to this resistance of not wanting to stay with the experience. It's actually the courage to willingly stay present with what is. In this example of waiting for my test results, once I was able to truly surrender to the experience, and again, this took a few days. This didn't happen just by saying, what is this, and sitting down with it for one or two sittings. But once I was able to surrender to it, the grip of fear did dissolve completely, and surprisingly, what remained was the experience and a sense of genuine equanimity. The dark and closed down feeling, the only way I could describe it, it was replaced by sunlight, fresh air, a sense of freedom. Totally different. So the struggle with fear that I just described was very intense for me, and again, it took several days, but the learning experience for me went very deep, and the lessons remained. A few weeks ago, I received a call from my doctor, and he told me that there were signs of a cancerous tumor in my kidney and that I needed to have further tests, and I also needed to prepare to schedule surgery. And of course, that was initially very shocking, and the first thing that I thought was remembering how many times I've said in here, we're all just one doctor's visit away from falling through the thin ice. And the fact is, I fell through the thin ice. When I took in what he was telling me, I fell right into the icy water. But within a very short time, I also remembered to say yes to the experience, to really be able to say yes to it. It was interesting because part of me was open and willing to experience what was going on, and another part of me was weaving this grim and dark story of me and my cancer with all of the closing down in the body. It's almost like there are these, well, we all know we have many me's, these two different parts of myself simultaneously. But saying yes to the experience allowed me to turn away from the story. It is a story of doom. And instead, I was able to turn toward the understanding that regardless of what might happen, regardless of what might happen externally, this exact thing was my path to living most genuinely. These weren't words for me, by the way. They weren't empty words. And in a way, I actually began and continue to look forward to this experience as a way to work with my own deepest attachments, particularly my attachment to comfort, my attachment to control, my attachment to my body, which is very deep, and of course, my attachment to my future. Saying yes means that my aspiration to live more genuinely is more important to me than it is to indulge the story of fear and doom. So remarkably, this episode of falling through the thin ice, which did happen, I just went right into it. It was remarkably short. It isn't that the fear is gone, because in truth, I still have anxiety about what's going to happen to me, particularly in the middle of the night when the defenses are down. But the fear does not predominate. And for the most part, I'm able to relate to the fear as just a normal human conditioned response to perceived danger, because that's all it is. Although the CAT scan that I had a couple weeks ago confirmed that the tumor is in fact cancerous, I don't have any physical symptoms of it. And the good news is that it's very unlikely that the cancer has spread to other parts in my body. And so the doctor, the surgeon, feels that he could take it out, hopefully without complications, that he could take it out. And that would be the end of it. And the hope is that they'll be able to take it out without removing my whole kidney. That at least is the plan. Nonetheless, there are some specific challenges involved in this that I'm going to have to face with that I know at one point in my life would have seemed beyond daunting. And at this point, again, at least sometimes, I'm actually looking forward to them. I actually want to be forced to work with these things that I never, ever would have chosen to work with on my own. So I'm not a masochist. Most of you know me. I'm not talking about this in that way. I'm talking about the fact that we all know we have an edge. We all know there's places we don't want to go and practice. And yet we know we need to go there eventually. And so, again, for me, this is a way of pushing me to the one edge, the one place that I thought I was never going to be able to go to on my own. I mentioned that in my early years of practice, I had the expectation that practice could free me from fear altogether. And now it's many years later, it's clear to me that practice is not about being completely free from fear as much as it is as not needing to be free from fear. And there's a really crucial difference between these two understandings. Not having to be free from fear means we no longer see it as a flaw. We no longer see it as a weakness. We no longer see it as something that we have to get rid of within ourselves. We understand that fear is just an all too human response to danger. And it's not going to change. We can learn to relate to it differently, but we don't have to have it be gone completely in order to be free. So the more we understand what it means to say yes to fear, the less we feel the need to push it away when it arises. And instead, we can see it, we can relate to it as an actual catalyst on our path. We can actually be thankful for it. Earlier I said that whatever we can't say yes to is the exact direction of our path. And you may want to consider where, in this moment, what is it that you can't say yes to? What is it that you think or believe that you can't say yes to? And can you see very specifically how saying yes to this exact thing would allow you to live as genuinely and as authentically as possible? It would allow you to become free. So this is not a theoretical thing. What I'm trying to say is when we feel distress and we automatically think something's wrong and the body automatically reacts as if something is wrong, we can override this with the conscious mind of a practice understanding that understands that in that moment, everything is exactly right because it's telling us exactly what we need to work with if we want to become free. So again, when we're willing to experience our life, whatever it is, and not hide out in fear and complacency, to me, this is the essence of living most genuinely. And the only price we have to pay for this is the risk of exposing ourselves to the discomfort of perceived danger. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about this here today and I asked you to come is because I didn't want to just announce this by email. I wanted to avoid any unnecessary melodrama that might come with this. The surgery is scheduled to take place in a few weeks. But the main reason I wanted to talk about this is because to me, this is an example of the fact that practice actually works, and how important, how really critically important practice is. It is possible to shed the excess baggage of even our deepest conditioning. And it's also possible, and I know many of you may know this, that we can have fear. We can still have fear and still have genuine equanimity. It's not our enemy. So that's all I really wanted to say. And if any of you want to ask anything, please feel free. June?
How can we help you?
Say that again?
How can we help you?
You could help me by, if this triggers anything in you, use it to go deeper in your own practice. You know, we say these lines all the time. Time is fleeting. Appreciate this precious life. They actually mean something, you know. So sometimes it's a good reminder that we don't have endless time. But actually, we're okay. Elizabeth is a super duper helper, and if she would like anyone to help, she will let you know.
I do want to say that, having had cancer myself and going through surgery, was easier for me in a way. You know, there's that little part of me that wants to be able to take this away for you, and so forth. And it's just very interesting. Everyone's going to have a different set of reactions come up.
Yeah, it's interesting because this is harder for me than yours was.
I'll see you later.
Anybody else? Yeah. Actually, I can amend that statement. I do want to say, I want to say this. It's true, when Elizabeth had very little melodrama with her cancer, and it was like a fairly quick sequence of decisions and going through the thing, and it wasn't that hard. It was hard in some ways, but it wasn't as hard as this is, because this is triggering my own particularly deepest fears. But at the same time, I'm very aware that I would rather go through this. I thought very specifically, rather go through this than lose you or either of my two daughters, having to have either one of them have something like this or you have something like this. I would rather go through it myself. So I can say this, but what I said before was true too. Yeah.
Well, there are two things that came to my mind. One of them is, you know, I've not been in the situation of having that diagnosis myself, but for dealing with the closest person to me. And that fear of losing that person is very, very strong and hard to deal with. And then the watching of the suffering was really hard during the chemo and the radiation therapy. But, you know, other than that, I'm just wondering about this process. I mean, maybe this sounds like a dumb question, but is part of the process of looking at that fear just like really strongly imagining what's the very worst thing that can happen and just looking that in the face over and over, and somehow it starts to subside? Or, you know, because I always think that's, maybe it's kind of a cliche, well, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? And I, you know, with cancer, it seems like sort of simple, well, you could die, and then you're just kind of dealing with the same question and existential question that we all have. Either it happens sooner, and how do you deal with that, or it's going to happen later, but it is going to happen. And I guess I just wonder, now that you're looking at your own mortality more.
Well, I don't want to make this sound more dramatic or anything, but the fact is, I don't expect I'm going to die from this. I do believe, I mean, I have a 90% chance of survival. I have a 90% chance of the operation being successful. In a way, I'm looking at it as they're going in and fixing my carburetor or taking out a sludge in one part of it, and they have to go in there with their stuff and take it out. And if they take it out and there are no complications, I will be normal from this. And the fact that the cancer hasn't spread makes the catastrophic thinking very reduced. So I do realize it's possible that could happen, but that's not the source of my particular fears. My particular fears are just a result of my own very deep conditioning having to do with fear of being tortured in particular ways. And I know there's certain things that are going to happen during and after the procedure that for me are literally my worst nightmare. And so what I'm doing to work with this is every time the thought of this comes up and my body begins to close down into a dark place, I remember just to say yes. And I remember, in fact, I had a laminated sheet with me for the first week and a half that this was happening to remind me that this is the exact thing that I need to happen in order to live the life that I truly want to live. And when I remember that, it overrides the automatic reactions that come up. And I'm able to turn toward it in a way that allows me to stay with the experience. It almost always subsides into an experience of calm. And in fact, even visualizing some of my imagined worst scenarios, lying in bed and just imagining them happening, and just lying there and being with it. And so for me, this is a way, no matter what happens during the procedure, this is just very, very useful for my practice.
When you say being with it, could you flesh that out just a little bit? Because I think we so commonly think that being with it means thinking about it, catastrophizing, believing our most believed thoughts, weaving a story of me and a scenario, and emoting, period.
Okay, so I don't mean any of those things. I assumed it was understood that for me, being with the experience means staying very directly with the visceral experience that's happening in the body, and for me, breathing them in on the in breath to the center of the chest and just letting them be there. And I understand what they are. I understand their deep conditioning. I know that in the moment, because I don't have strong physical sensations, I don't have symptoms from this, so I know what they are. They're a psychological something that I have to deal with, so it makes it a little bit more straightforward. And I've learned from my past experiences, this is like not the first time I've had to deal with physical symptoms or things around physical illness. So I feel like the many years of my practice are allowing me to work with this in a very effective way. Yeah, Michael.
So when we go back to the two examples, the one was being fearful performing in front of people, and the other one was you getting this prostate test and worrying about the results, and that you put yourself in the position of forcing yourself into that situation of confronting your fear of performing. So you would have all this anxiety before you performed, and then you would perform, and then it got easier as you did it. What is the difference between that and the test, or this test, in the anticipation of the fear of what's going to happen? Was it your belief that you thought that if you did this enough times and performed, you would obliterate it, as opposed to just being with that fear and anxiety of performing, and then viscerally it subsides over time? They seem almost like they're very similar, except for your belief that you would be cured of it.
The belief is one part of it, but the real part of it is when I did all those tasks in my early years of like singing on Fisherman's Wharf and wearing bad clothes, and I did a lot of things like that. The idea was I was confronting my behaviors. I was stamping out my behaviors. I wasn't actually experiencing, feeling, staying with the actual experience of fear. I didn't know what fear was. I was working with the manifestations of fear. So, like, say I was afraid of speaking in public. I would go force myself to speak in public. I would override the trembling, the rapid heartbeat, and all of that. I would, like, tough through it, but it didn't mean that I felt it. The reason I joined Toastmasters back, this was right before I started teaching, I joined Toastmasters, which is a group where you, everybody's in it, it's petrified of public speaking, and so you give talks and you rehearse and you get good at it. I didn't do it to get good at public speaking. I did it so I'd have a forum where I could actually get up there, and instead of giving a good talk, I would get up there and feel what fear was. And so this is more an example of not so much going against my behaviors and in that sense working with fear. This is more a sense of literally welcoming, or as Chuck said a couple weeks ago, turning toward fear, embracing it, really wanting to feel what fear is. Whether it goes away or not is not the issue. It's not the agenda. It's nice when it goes away. It's nice when that very dark feeling kind of just goes through me, and then what's left over is a feeling of ease. But if that doesn't happen, I'm not disappointed. I'm not deeply disappointed, I'll put it that way, okay? Yes, Mitchell?
You talked about the experience with the prostate results as like a 3-day kind of thing. Where eventually we got completely rid of the baggage of it, of the fear. It seems a little different than some of like the core belief, core pain fears that are just like that.
You're talking about core fears, like on fears of unworthiness?
Yeah, like at what practice, the difference in what practice is.
The practice isn't any different. I mean, in this particular fear, the fear was fear of, again, it was a terror of being tortured. It was a fear that I couldn't handle it. All of that, it's not the same as the fear of being unworthy, but it's close enough. And the practice actually is really the same.
I meant like the practice timeline.
The what?
Practice timeline. The one is freed up in 3 days, but you're not suggesting that would happen with the fear of unworthiness, so you could work with it for 3 days. And
if you were in a situation where your sense of worth was going to be really challenged, you were going to go into a situation, maybe you'd have an opportunity to work with this very intensely for a period of 2 or 3 days. It doesn't mean that if you work with it and have you go through this and experience freedom from it, that it's going to be obliterated anyway. You know, I remember when this happened, when I really did go through this, I didn't even care if I lived or died anymore. I felt so free in the moment. I called up Joko at 5 o'clock in the morning. I woke her up just to tell her what happened. I was so like very excited about it. It didn't mean that
she didn't think so.
Yeah, it didn't mean that I was, obviously it didn't mean I was free from fear permanently. It was like just a step. It was an excellent learning experience because it was the process, but there was still residual fear remaining. So you may have to do this many times with the core belief fears. Yeah, Elizabeth?
I think one thing that's a distinction here is that in the Fisherman's Wharf thing, you were actually planning to do something, and it was something that you thought was in your control to do, and you did it, and you got the results that you got, but you could also decide not to do it at any time. Just it's sort of like Sashin, you know, there's a point at which it's going to end. With the prostate test, once you practiced with it, and then of course when you got the results and it was benign, any residual fear could go back into the swamp, but the situation was over for the time being. I think with our core beliefs, they may rise up situationally, but they're so deep-seated. And in this situation, part of it is not happening now. Part of it has already happened. Part of it will probably happen up ahead, but it's an unfoldment, just like our life is. So it's a perfect paradigm for the fact that none of us gets out of here without this kind of thing where we're going to have ongoing practice with things that we didn't order on our menu.
Yeah, and one little subpoint from what you just said, you know, one of the five questions that we ask as basic practice question is what's actually going on right now? And honestly, because I use the five questions with this too, in a way there's nothing going on right now. When I'm lying in my bed feeling some form of dread, there's nothing happening other than what my mind is generating, thinking about, you know, the imagined. They're not actually imagined scenarios. They're scenarios that are going to take place, but they're imagined in the moment because they're not happening now. And that's very important to realize that when we're caught in fear in how we're dealing with it. And I don't know what's going to happen when I, you know, end up going through this actual process. I suspect that I will still have the some of the deep-seated conditioning come up, but I also suspect that the way I'm going to relate to it is not going to be the way I would have related to it even a couple of years ago. I'll let you know in a couple of months. Yeah, Monica?
When you're trying to feel the fear and experience the present moment, are you using the five questions, what is this, or do you have some other way?
I use the five questions sometimes when I want to do it systematically. Normally it comes in waves, and what I'm doing mainly is just remembering to say yes to it and remembering the idea that this exact thing, regardless of how it turns out, this exact thing is what I want and need most in order to become free. And when I remember that, the willingness to stay present with the physical experience, the willingness to do the what is this practice, literally do the what is this practice, which means to really feel the present moment, the willingness is much greater. And I could breathe it into the heart and just stay with it for fairly decent periods of time. Yeah, one last question, June.
Israel, when you were talking about dressing in weird clothes or doing all those other things that challenged your
yeah.
image, an imposter. In other words, if I do something and that I'm afraid of, I'm not necessarily being with the fear. I'm adding something else, and then when that succeeds in my mind, that's something different from the fear itself.
Well, of course, it's adding something. I was adding it on purpose in order to feel the fear.
But what I'm wondering also is, I understand that.
I'm not advocating this, by the way.
No, I understand. But feeling good about having done something in some ways takes away from actually being with the fear.
That's exactly the point that I was trying to make.
Okay.
In thinking that I had power and control
right.
over it, mm-hmm. I was deluding myself
right.
into thinking that I was obliterating my fear. And in the meantime, I was never really feeling it. That's why it was a misconception about, I was using this as an example, not as as a really good way of working with fear. I was using it as a misconception. Although I want to say that it can also be a really good way of fear, working with fear, if you understand that say you do fear going to your workplace dressed not in a nice way because you fear disapproval. If you did that, but went with the intent to really feel what fear is, as opposed to just kind of obliterate the fear, then it's a subtle difference between the two, but it really is a difference, then the practice might be very valuable. All right? So if any other questions, anything else comes up about this, please feel free, bring it up to talk about it. Yeah?
I just wanted to say, I think, for me, and I assume for everyone, the value of Sesshin is when you sit there, everything will come up, and you've agreed to sit there hour after hour, day after day, and that it's one thing to listen to you speak and another to have the opportunity to practice. And this really, in my experience, takes a lot of practice to do something we really don't want to do, is sit there with fear hour after hour.
I totally agree with you. Sitting here listening to the talk is pales in comparison. I do also want to say, though, that we could sit several hundred sesshins, and as good as that is, we can still avoid facing the one thing that we don't want to face because we have a choice. And so sometimes life, not sometimes, life is always our best teacher. And eventually we might have the good fortune of life presenting us with the one thing that we need to work with most. And what happens is the years of sesshin that you're doing, that we're doing, trains us to be able to work with it and deal with it. Whereas maybe before we couldn't have. But it doesn't mean that everything's going to come up in sesshin. Yeah.
Ezra, could I just ask, do you also at all include environmental awareness after you've felt the sensations and the reaction in the body and heard the most believed thoughts and let it be felt with the heart's breath? Do you also include environmental awareness at some point?
To me, that, so I didn't want to go into the whole practice of what is this. Mm-hmm. To me, part of the practice of what is this is zeroing in on the strongest sensations that are happening. And so for me, it's like the very closed down feeling in the body. It's a subjective experience, dark subjective experience. I stay with that. It then becomes like a little broader in the body. I breathe it in. And then as that subsides, I open up to the awareness of the room and to the air. And gradually the experience becomes more one of just being with the whole thing. So yes, that is included. And it just depending how the process is at any given time. Yeah. And this has to be the last one, okay, Al?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that getting back to June's initial question, that this is also a good opportunity for all of us to practice loving kindness without any attachment to any results or any perceived benefits, but just simply remembering to breathe Ezra and Elizabeth into our hearts.
Thank you. It's always good to practice loving kindness. So thank you. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.
This moment, compassion's way.